It's really interesting. I use the term branding, Jim, because that's the world that I'm in of marketing. But we're talking about go-to-market messaging. What exactly are you leading with for your go-to-market strategy? So I work with GTM teams 24/7 to build this exact thing. What's going out? Again, every component of their go-to-market strategy has to be rooted in the brand. What tactics they use, the processes that they've built behind the scenes, who's doing what, when, and why, everything should back into the brand. And that's why it's so important. It is the crux of a go-to-market strategy.
Welcome to the B2B Digital Marketer Podcast, a podcast helping you to end your struggle with digital marketing, helping you to pave a new and better path to target and capture your ideal customer. Each week, we teach you how insiders and experts debunk the dreary and become engines of innovation. Now, here's your host, Jim Rembach.
Okay, B2B DM gang, we're going to have a great conversation today because I had Kate DeLeo on the show with us, and we're going to talk about how you really need to stop storytelling to make more sales. And I know that's counterintuitive to everything that you probably hear in regards to what you're supposed to do to be successful and differentiate in today's world, but Kate's going to tell us otherwise. Kate, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim. I'm excited to be here and talk all things branding and business. It's going to be great.
Absolutely. So, but before we get into the meats of all this, if you could share a little bit with the B2B DM gang, your background.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's funny. I kind of fell into this thing called branding, aka messaging for marketing and sales. And it was really on accident that I fell into it. I actually started my career in outbound sales at the time of the market crashing back in around 2007, 2008. And it was pure necessity that I had to go get a job. Right. And so I took a cold calling sales job to call IT professionals and sell them $2,500 training classes over the phone. And it was really in that job, Jim, that I recognized a few key pieces. Number one, nobody's going to listen to me if I just blab on and on. Number two, psychologically, there are three key pieces that of information that somebody wants to know before they're willing to really have that in-depth conversation. And number three, keep it simple. How do I get away from making it all about me and making it about them in a manner that feels authentic? It feels right to me, and it's going to authentically want to get somebody to come to the table, have that conversation. So that was my background. Got recruited out into the sales and marketing world from there, worked in corporate America, and then I side hustled for many years while having a family, and then took this business full time in 2019. And so to date, I've worked with about 300 companies globally, helping them build brands that are going to win more work.
Well, okay. So you opened up a door for me, and I didn't really necessarily pick that up very clearly in your book, by the way, which is Muting the Megaphone. You said there's three key pieces that people want in order for them to essentially engage with you. What are those three key pieces?
Yes. So it's interesting. I had stumbled across this by pure trial and error, being in my early 20s and taking that sales job, and I've spent over a decade actually proving this out with neuroscientists and psychologists. And so buyer psychology suggests that at a baseline, we need to know, tell me what you do, tell me how you solve my problem, and then tell me how you're different and better than the rest. One, two, three. In that order, interestingly enough, it's a formula. A plus B plus C equals the moment when somebody goes, yes, I've got it. Now tell me more about your products and services. Now let's dig into the details. And so that kind of formulaic approach is your first 15 to 30 seconds of any pitch. That's what we're really getting at. And it's kind of a 1-2-3 punch.
Well, then the key is getting all of that right. And that's where muting the megaphone gets into this. And before we start into that, there's a, like I talked about, storytelling where we've been, this is what you're supposed to do. There's even been, organizations that essentially will provide the services of helping you to, create a story.
Right.
Your brand. I'm not going to get into those specifics. But you say storytelling is ignorant and egotistical. How so?
All right. So for my fellow storytellers listening into this today, okay, so here's the deal. At the core, stories have their places. So I would never tell you that story is bad in general. But when we're talking about a true brand pitch, aka that initial leading go-to-market messaging, that first 30 seconds of what somebody experiences and understands with you and your business. All right. The problem with storytelling is that it's a one-way monologue. Donald Miller came out with an amazing book well over 10 years ago called Story Brand. Fantastic. Beautiful principle, which really said, make it all about our customers, right? Put them at the heart of the journey, make them into hero. The problem is that nobody told us how to write that story in such a way where that was actually the case. And so we marketers went very rogue and we made it all about us. Here's the thing. When you're listening to a story, have you ever noticed that it is a one-way monologue? You have one person talking and one person listening. How exactly does that leave room and space for your audience to actually engage with you and share with you what's really going on? You're just telling them. And that's my issue with storytelling. It's not that stories aren't good in the sense that they have their place, but when we talk about first line of defense, somebody immediately introduces themselves, you're immediately delivering that pitch to the bit about the business. Cut the story crap and get into a brand conversation.
Yeah. Okay, so I think in the book you talk about, and this is where this may fall into, and you talk about that rogue element, is that storytelling has been taken and placed into something that you call megaphone marketing. What is megaphone marketing?
I call it megaphone marketing. It's so interesting. I think we've all been on the other end of it. Have you ever gone to somebody's website and do you remember 5 years ago? Five, 10 years ago, the glory days of sales funnels. Remember this? The ClickFunnels pages? And you hit the page and it's like, you don't even know what to click. It never stops scrolling. There's buttons and this and that and feature, benefit, video. And you're like, it's overwhelm. At the same time, if you've ever been on a sales call with somebody else or in a discovery call or a demo, and they don't even stop talking, then you can't even get a breath in. That's megaphone marketing. And the problem is I'll be really honest, I think megaphone marketing has stemmed from us as founders and as marketing and sales leaders, where we have a bit of FOMO. I think we have a deep-seated fear that, but Kate, hold on, if I don't tell them all the cool features and benefits and this and that, they're not going to understand how amazing we are and they're not going to buy.
So, okay. And I think that also leads into what you had said in regards to too many B2B marketers and sellers are like chameleons, right? So how are they like chameleons?
Well, I think we've all done this, right? Where we really try to flex ourselves so much to the target audiences that we're potentially talking to that we actually lose sight of the true depth of the deepest heart pain we solve for our ideal customers. And I think chameleon marketing is not good in the standpoint of, you know, trying to adjust your message so often to get anybody and everybody to buy. And you and I were talking about this earlier, Jim, that there's this principle that I always say, which is that you are not in the business of convincing. You're in the business of converting. And as an organization, I think intrinsically we kind of get it, but here's the thing. It's not your job to sell to anybody and everybody in hopes that they're going to buy from you. It's actually your job to put some stakes in the ground to say, this is exactly who we are. This is exactly the ideal customer that we're going to serve. And allow this principle of liking, like attracting liked to really happen, where you want to serve and message to the ideal people who are going to have the highest probability of buying, are going to find the most value in what you offer, are going to be happy, repeatable customers, and ultimately, it's a win-win. And if that's the scenario, Jim, why are we flexing 24/7 to hope that we get this guy over here and this gal over here and this person there?
Because we just need to get sales, man. I got to get my numbers, right? So it's that pressure that takes you sideways, right?
It is. I do. And I really respect and understand that. Again, coming from a sales background, and I'm an entrepreneur, so I have to sell. Hey, listen, I'm in B2B services, right? So let's call it out. We have to sell. But the thing is that if I spend my time trying to build a brand that has 17 layers of messaging and 17 different messages, I can guarantee you that as a salesperson, we are going to be exhausted. We will not be as good. We will not be as sharp on that call. We will not connect as well with people because we are pulled in too many directions. It's kind of like, imagine going from, I was telling this to you earlier, I went from being a mom of one, married a guy with three kids. I'm a lot more tired. Let's just say from one to four, that is exhausting. Can you imagine if we have to go from one or two core target audiences to trying to speak to 10 to 20? That's chameleon marketing and that's chameleon branding.
Well, and we'll get into that even a little bit more because I think, you know, some of the messaging needs to shift and in an organization. We'll talk about that in a moment. But, you know, you talk about, I think this is where it kind of gets into how do we implement and how do we move down from this conceptual piece to actual implementation. And you say that we need to write our brand in the right color pen. What's that?
Well, you know what's so funny is I think I kind of alluded to this earlier. In general, brand is not aspirational. So it's really fascinating because if you write your brand and you message your company in the hopes of who you think you're supposed to be, or while our competitors are saying this, and so we should be like that. Honestly, people can sniff a fake a mile away. You will never own your message with confidence if you're trying to brand who you think you're supposed to be. You brand for who you are here and now, for the products and services you have here and now, for your current mission, vision, values, and your culture and your authentic personality. So what I mean by this is that your tone of voice ultimately is critical as a brand. It's I'll give you an example. So when I do branding exercises with companies, we do a very silly but fun exercise where I ask them, okay, if your brand were a person, who would it be? Now, before you tell me, oh, we're kind, we're smart, we're funny, hang on. I want them to think typically of like a public figure or celebrity. We're listening. If they were to close their eyes, could they hear how that person talked? So I've written Oprah brands. You know how Oprah talks. You go to school. Ryan Reynolds, Kevin Hart, Simon Sinek, Anderson Cooper, Donald Trump. All of these various voices, you could almost kind of close your eyes, couldn't you? And hear what they sound like. And that's a secret sauce to writing a great brand, is because here's the final piece I want to mention. You have to know what color pen you are, because the tendency when we write, you ever sat down and wrote that email and you look back at it and you're like, well, that was a bunch of corporate mumbo jumbo. I better do something with that email, right? So here's the deal. As our brains write, we write it out, and it does sound like corporate-y gobbledygook, even when I write it. And then we ask, hold on, how would so-and-so say it? What color pen are we? And it allows us to go tighten, shorten it, create a rhythm. Do we use an exclamation point? Do we ask a question here? Do we have a mic drop moment? And Jim, that's where kind of the art piece of brand comes in. So that it sounds like you, feels like you. It's something that would come out of your mouth. So that it's not just cool words on a website page, but if you get on the next Zoom call with a prospect, would you say it? Would it be natural to you and your sales team? That's the critical component of knowing what color or pen you are.
Well, and as you say that, I start thinking about this whole alignment piece from one seller to the next. If I have multiple,
right?
How do I get that consistency so that there is that, you know, connection component and alignment? I mean, I think we talk about, you know, the things that people need, right? Is that, you know, that consistency piece is to me the overriding governance and all of that.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. So when I work with companies, obviously I want that founder in the room or that CEO. That's really imperative because they do hold the keys to the brand. But I'll tell you what, I don't take a project as well if I don't have sales and marketing leadership represented in that room. And I also typically want operations or product teams in there if they're delivering, like, let's say it's B2B SaaS, you know, something like that. Here's the point. These stakeholders are critical, and especially having sales in that room. Brand is not just a marketing thing. It is truly about building go-to-market messaging and creating alignment between your sales and your marketing functions. And so for me, I look at this going, how do we take what you wrote and deliver that into email templates, sales collateral? Do we need that big pitch deck, or could we just sell with a simple three-page slide deck and then get into the proposal? All of this stuff actually impacts even sales process, and it allows marketing to better support sales in a way where everybody's kind of speaking language.
Well, even as you're saying that, I started even thinking down the line. So I mean, one of the things, especially if you talk about that SaaS example, you know, is stickiness and retention and renewals.
Right.
If I don't have my, you know, client success, customer support, what, you know, whatever you call your team, all the way through from the client retention piece, your churn rate is going to be higher.
But you're actually spot on. So it's funny, I work with a number of fast growing companies. They might be a well-funded startup or a pretty established B2B SaaS company. And they're building RevOps at a rapid fire pace, right? We know that the future of RevOps has really shifted in the last few years, but they've got marketing, they've got sales, they've got customer success, they've got a RevOps leader, all right, a CRO. And here they are, and they're trying to make this happen from an implementation standpoint, from a technology standpoint, best practices, processes, reducing churn, all the things. If your message at the top is not consistent, and you don't understand how to infiltrate that at every step in the buyer journey, you're going to lose people. Because they do need to see, hear, and feel the reminder of the promise of this is what they do for me, this is how they solve my problem, and this is how they're different. And it creates loyalty. It does reduce churn. I've got clients that we've seen huge reduction in churn rates because they implemented the brand top down, bottom up.
Well, even as you say that, there was a very interesting piece of research that has just come out that is part of an interview I had with Matt Dixon, who is the author of the book called The Jolt Effect, right? And he said for decades, we've been working from the same playbook in marketing and sales, which is that we're trying to break the status quo, right? Hey, you need
right.
But what they're finding is that like 60% or greater of all sales opportunities in the B2B space are actually lost to no decision.
That's correct.
And so when you take that into consideration, what's the driver, you know, behind that? And it's a particular bias that's associated with, and you said FOMO, but it's a little bit different. It's FOMU, which is the fear of messing up. So in other words, I'm implementing, you know, this particular product or solution or service, whatever it may be, and, you know, I can't afford for it to, you know, or I can't afford to make my head roll or my butt to get, you know, slashed because decision. And so we need to, that's where client success, I think, you know, has it become even more vital into that whole, you know, RevOps and retention pieces because clients, they don't want to make a mistake on you.
That's correct. And the other piece I think is fascinating. I've talked with a number of teams that when they reduce that just pure ghosting rate, you know, that I don't have any decision from these people, what the heck do I do? Okay. So if you go back to those principles of those three things, and I call this the brand trifecta, okay? So messaging-wise, it includes a tagline that answers the question, what do you do? Followed by a value proposition statement that directly says, here's the pain we know you're feeling. Now here's how we can solve that pain with you, okay? And then the third thing, differentiator statements, the 1, 2, 3 big bullet points of how you're different and better than the rest. Okay, that's the brand trifecta messaging-wise. Here's what's interesting. The reason that this is so important is if we go back to that buyer psychology for a second, the brain really clearly understands that if you have a provocative piece of new information, such as a cool tagline that says what you do, a really amazing value proposition statement that says, here's how you solve my problem, the brain needs to process that information and it needs to be able to make a comparison between you and the competition clearly to understand, I'm going to compartmentalize this in my mind. I need to make sure I'm tracking with you. And okay, so let me make sure I'm understanding this. So tell me how you're different. Let me make sure I'm understanding this. Psychologically, here's the bottom line. Those three components clear the noise for somebody to get to the point where they actually care about wanting to know about your products and service. Many times when we have a drop off on decision making, it is through overwhelm or pure confusion. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is, are we getting lost into the weeds of our own cool thing? Have we really actually backed up to the top and created an order of operations of what somebody needs to know? In fact, do we have a proposal that's in the exact same order as if somebody were to go from the homepage of the website to the about page to the products or services page? Are we logically thinking about what we're saying in what order? So that person can go organically down the path of decision-making and details at their own pace. This is important We find that when you have that brand trifecta at the tip top, homepage language on a website, it allows that person to self-select in and go, now I get it. Now tell me how it works. How much does it cost? What's included? What's the process to work with you? Da, 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 da. If we lead with all that without telling them the big stuff at the top, you lost them. Guys, this is basic high school writing. Write the thesis statement. What I'm trying to propose here is write your darn thesis statement with this brand trifecta. That's the point.
Okay, but we have to build into that brand trifecta. And you say that you have clients do three key exercises to create rich and colorful views of how your brand shows up in the world. What are those three exercises?
Well, the three exercises for how your brand shows up in the world get around this idea of your brand's personality and tone of voice. So let's talk about kind of, Jim, tranches of work for writing this thing. Tranche number one is brand personality, tone of voice. And there's three exercises. One of them I shared with you earlier, which is, if your brand were a person, who would it be? The second thing is we actually will do a very simple exercise where we will begin to rank out our personality traits. Am I more approachable or more, I guess, elitist? Am I more modern or more conventional? Am I more this or that? Kind of ranking on a scale. I have a really cool chart in my book that shows this of how you can almost rank yourself going down to understand where do we fall on this spectrum of personality traits? Not just me as the leader of sales or Susan, the leader of marketing, right? But the brand as a whole. And then the third exercise that we do to really understand how do we show up in the world is something called brand archetypes. Now, this might sound fluffy because I understand brand sounds super fluffy. But actually what brand archetypes do is it gives you a clear distinction of your top three personality traits that show up the most prominently when you walk in the room. Have you ever done StrengthsFinder before? Okay. You know the promise of how it says, okay, you have all these strengths. We want to just understand what are your top five. Okay, so same thing with archetypes. Archetypes, there's 12 archetypes for personalities or strengths that you can have as a company. The job here is to choose your top three that if you as a company were to walk into the room, what would somebody experience first? These three exercises give you a deep understanding of this is who we are, this is how we show up in the world, and this is how we're therefore going to write the brand. That's imperative before you start to write the message.
And then you actually get into and talk about three key exercises to help clients deeply understand who they are going after and why.
Yeah. So this is the second tranche of work. You know, it's funny. This gets missed. Like, I know my target audience. Like, really? Tell me more. So, you know, I think we kind of do, right? I would never say that I've ever worked with a company that's like, I have no idea who to talk to. Hang on. Here's the three things that you want to be doing, though. Number one, I recommend that you guys just get a pen and paper, make a list of all potential buyers. So you could write down 10 to 20 types of company sizes, sectors, anything. You're like, well, we could go after this group. It may even be, hey, we serve mid-sized manufacturers. And in a mid-sized manufacturing company, we know we have to talk to the CEO, the CFO, and the COO. We have three distinct buyers in that company who are decision makers. All right, write it down. Your first step is you have to niche in a little bit. You gotta niche in. What's the saying? Niches lead to riches. So the question that we always ask, though, is, okay, well, hold on. Who's the happiest buyer? Who's the most repeat buyer? Who's the easiest to work with? If you think about that one client that drove you nuts, if you were to reverse that, who do you really like working with? You're going to find a pattern pop up. You're going to find a pattern of actually, we really can brand for the 70%. So here's the rule. Your brand message should speak to the one or two or three audiences where you think 70% of your revenue will come from. With an acknowledgement that 30% of your revenue could come over here. But those are kind of more outliers. And are you actively going to go after them? No, they might find you. Maybe it's a referral or, you know. But you want to focus on the big groups. So that's the first thing. The second thing that you're going to do is build out a set of buyer criteria for each of those top audiences. So like, we've selected healthcare mid-sized companies, manufacturing mid-sized companies, and whatever. Great. Number your paper 1 to 20. And then what you're going to do for each of those is you're going to decide, well, what does ideal scenario look like? Who's the ideal healthcare company? They have how much revenue? How many employees? Are they located in a certain region in the United States or in the world? who in the company is the key decision maker. But then you got to go further. Psychographics, level of bureaucracy, who cuts the check? Are these people open to bringing in consultants? Are they coachable and teachable? Do they make timely decisions? Are they super intuitive? Do they think they have all the answers or no? Start to get into the minds of, if you think about who do we love to talk to, that's the fastest sale. And then finally, the third exercise is to do a bit of analysis and ask yourself, okay, if I've defined ideal for this audience, what's the bottom level heart pain I'm actually solving for companies? I think I know, but is it deeper than just a revenue thing or a bottom line thing that I'm solving? What's really driving them? Why do they care about increasing revenue? Why do they care about improving the bottom line? By doing that analysis, often what comes out of that, Jim, is really, really rich kind of language that gets at the heart of what you're actually solving for that company. And that's what we use to rate your brand.
Well, and as you're saying that, I start thinking about, and this is where we got into, and I kind of opened the door just a little bit last time, is all of these things helped us to go in to be able to build that brand trifecta. But then when we get in a particular organization, we start getting some, you know, very distinct nuances between different levels of the organization because
yes,
it has to be different. So therefore, we need to be very mindful of the fact that we need to have more than one brand trifecta.
That's right. Yeah, you're so spot on. You're so spot on. So I never think that you, okay, listen, I don't think you ever have to boil the ocean here and trying to fit everybody into a single brand trifecta, unless you're somebody like myself who really has one or two predominant audiences that actually have the same heart pain that gets solved, and therefore I could have a pretty simple message, and that's cool. But many of my clients, we have what we call a layered brand architecture, where homepage of the website, the top 15 seconds is the top level brand trifecta for your company. Speaks to all audiences as the pattern of what we solve for everybody. And then if you ever go to a website and you see that for CEOs, for marketing, for whatever, and you can click to go to that specific page or for industry specific pages, when you get to that level, you can have a supportive brand trifecta for each of those groups that says, now here, CFO, here's what we solve for you. Here's how we're different for you. Because that CFO cares about what? Risk, protection, you know, that stuff. Whereas maybe the CRO is like, yes, this is gonna bring in money, you know? And so the even just the nature of what you're gonna say to them needs to be a little different. So that's very common for small to mid-sized companies, even where we've got a top level and then maybe one or two layers down of supportive brand trifectas. They're all in the same tone of voice. They all work together, top down, bottom up. But then it feels like a really consistent message. Remember how I talked about order of operations? That person then can go down that rabbit trail and self-select into what they care about most.
And I think for me, talking about that particular issue where most of our deals and opportunities are lost by no decision, you start addressing the reasons as to why that is the case.
That's right. Do you know what's so funny? I tested this out with a client. So we had a particular SaaS company that went from over 6 months sales cycle down to about 60 days, which is just unreal. And what did we do? In this client, we had a top level brand trifecta for their particular product. We addressed head of sales, head of marketing, and then the CFO. Those were the three people. So we did a second layer down. Now, what was really interesting, and then by the way, we did have sections on their website where we had, you know, explainer videos and about us stories and, you know, white papers. You can definitely do a story there, blogs, great place for stories. Okay. All right. So we did all of that, but then we decided to test out some of the sales process in conjunction with this. So what we did is we decided, let's take a step back and you cold call somebody or you cold email them and they decide, yeah, I'm open to a discovery. So what we did is instead of having discovery call go into typically like a second discovery call for their stakeholders and then like a proposal call and then a close, that's atrocious. What we did is we decided, forget that nonsense. We're only going to do one discovery call and they need to hold the time and they better make sure they bring their stakeholders with them on that first call. And it's only going to be 45 minutes. So what we did is we asked them ahead of time, we sent a personal email. We said, hey, we're really excited to get on this call. here's the deal. Your time is precious. Can you please confirm that these leaders in your organization can be there? Oh, by the way, here's a video for each of them that they may want to watch. And then we sent a second follow-up email, said, hey, just making sure you had time to look at a couple of the core videos on our website that speak to the core features and benefits, because what we'd like to do is tailor this 45 minutes to the things that matter most to you. So if you can watch those videos ahead of time, each of them were like 1 to 2 minutes, that'd be great. We can really answer some of the direct questions for you. So instead of these people getting on a call saying, yeah, just tell me about the product, they already knew all about it. They know exactly what you do. They know all the details. And instead, they're getting on these calls going, I loved that one video. Here's the situation over here. Can you guys customize that? Because this is what we're dealing with. So you have a buyer or a prospect that is self-selected in, further down the buyer journey, has the right people in the room, and still holds that meeting, give a ballpark price, get a second call, close. So they went from 4 calls to 2.
Well, as you start talking about that, there's a couple constraints that exist with that.
Yeah.
One is an organization says, well, I don't have time to do that and have and carve out and have everybody, you know, for that particular meeting. I mean, so then for me as a seller, do I basically at that point say, you know, I need to go to another opportunity?
Yeah.
Wow.
Think about it. If they can't even rally the troops for this, how serious are they? When you go back and look at the history of who sold and sold quick or bought quickly, did they have the right people on the call? Were they willing to go connect schedules and make it happen? Uh-huh. Here's the thing. Your job is to say no to the good to say yes to the great. The time that you spend trying to chase down somebody that isn't even willing to watch a video, let them go. They don't fit your criteria of an ideal buyer then, candidly. And the time that you're going to waste means you could have gotten in front of the right person.
Okay, so then the other thing we kind of talked about a moment ago is the whole pressure of that I need to meet quota. You know, if I'm starting to talk about going through this particular, you know, process and I'm eliminating, you know, am I going to be able to make my numbers?
Yes. Now, here's the question. To ensure that that happens with anybody who has a quota, another key question that we want to think about in conjunction with this, though, is where are you getting your leads from? You should be getting your leads from poor sources. We're just reliant on inbound through Google Ads. How's that working for you? Right? How's that going?
I caught 20 bots today.
Right? So here's the question, actually. I think the principle is very simple. And this is, again, why I love getting sales teams in the room when we build this. Because I ask the whole group, because marketing, I love it. And I'm a marketer. But marketing's like, we're going to run ads. And I'm like, hold on, Bob. The question is this. Is if you've defined your ideal audiences, where do these people already show up? What rooms are they already in, digitally or face-to-face? Where do they go to solve problems? Where do they go to network? Where do they go to learn and grow? If it behooves you and your sales team to go teach a 30-minute workshop over Zoom in a particular CEO mastermind group, and that gets the trust and the connections and the relationships that you get the right person on the call to go close a deal, do it. This is about understanding what face-to-face channels and what digital channels are really going to enable. Even if you're a green sales rep, where can you show up? Where can you physically be in a room to network and make connections? Think like an entrepreneur. Where would they go? If you start thinking that way, chances are you're going to build a personal relationship with somebody who's probably willing to talk to you versus you having to cold email somebody. And that shifts the game.
Okay, well, as you're talking, I start, you know, also seeing a whole lot of, you know, information. Even talking about SaaS, you know, SaaS solutions that are all around intent, buyer intent, purchase intent, you know, and it's like, oh, no, you use intent data, you know, for whatever your demographic may be.
That's right.
And therefore go, but you, So how does that fit in, you know, an account-based marketing?
It certainly can. So let's talk about that, right? Because if you guys have a level of sophistication where you're like, yeah, that's great, Kate. You know, I've got sales leaders who can show up in the rooms, but we have 20 salespeople on our team and they're really smiling and dialing and doing emails and some of this outbound work. Okay, great. Obviously, buyer intent and leveraging that data is imperative because chances are the majority of the leads that are going to be put in front of your sales team are probably inbound coming through various digital channels, okay? Or you're at an event or at a trade show and you scan 3 million badges and then you start to track who's actually on your website, what's happening. That data is very important and you can use that. What you guys want to think about is what are the KPIs or the metrics that would make you then understand, ah, that's actually your ideal buyer because they spent 5 minutes on this page and 3 minutes on that page because they came back more than once. They keep coming back to this video. That you have to decide what actually you're going to track and why with that data to determine who's ideal and who you actually want to go after. That will probably allow these sales reps to be far more surgical then in who they talk to and what they decide they're going to spend their efforts on.
Okay, well, that's on the demand side. But what if I'm talking about, you know, just overall, you know, purchasing intent data from information source? They haven't come to my website. They haven't found me yet. So, I mean, how does that fit in?
It's a really good question. I do think it can fit into that. How much time you got? That's a big one. Here's the deal. I don't ever say go rogue without data. If you've got the data, use it. But go back to the questioning with purchasing intent data and understand, is the data we're collecting, are the parameters we've set to collect such data actually delineating our particular set of ideal buyers, or is it just a data stack? Which one is it? Data for data's sake is not good. Data that you have spent the time on the front end in accordance with your brand to decide what we're tracking and why and what we think the triggers are that would signal certain things, that's smarter. That's better. So it's going to require a bit more analysis before you just put the data in front of your sales team, point blank.
Okay. So, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm looking at this, you know, you explained the brand trifecta, all these exercises and all this work, our colors and all that, you know, gets us to be able to create the brand trifecta. But, and so if I think about now implementing this, and you kind of hit on it a little bit, but if you kind of, it can help, help us to understand, you know, critical, you know, these things are critical in regards to implementing the brand trifecta. And then these are some common pitfalls I see.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's funny. So I outlined in my book, by the way, kind of an implementation checklist that's probably helpful for folks that even on the sales side want to take a look at. It's kind of like, what's highest priority? What do you have to get done in the first couple of weeks? You go write the coolest thing in the world. Now what? First of all, get your darn website updated. I mean, my goodness. And whenever I hear marketing teams like, we have to redesign, stop it. No, you don't. Can you go update your text on your website? Update some copy? Can we start there, like the homepage? Just get a couple of pages done. Start with that. Second thing, proposals. Please get those done right away. Do you have a page in your proposal that clearly outlines your brand trifecta and about your organization before you get into the scope of work? Do you have your sales decks updated? Investor pitch decks. Other things that are imperative to get down, one-page sales sheets. If you happen to use sales sheets of any sort, get those updated right away. These are very simple copy swaps that can make a big impact immediately. Often in the first few weeks as well, things that we start to see getting updated is like email template copy. Beautiful. Get that moving too, right? So the sales team can iterate quickly and start to work with that. Don't wait 3 months to update the darn emails that your sales team's sending out. Oh my God, that's not helping anybody. Longer term things are, believe it or not, SEO. Advertising, you can wait a few more weeks. You know, there's different things. The main thing is, if you've got people in your pipeline that you're having conversations with and you have calls lined up, update what you need to get on that call and close. I want to see your first line of defense be whatever material somebody needs to close the deal, that better be updated right away. Then we can move into other things. Then we can talk about social media, etc. But it's imperative that marketing teams understand they need to be immediately communicating with sales teams, and sales teams better step up and say, here's what I need right now. You did all this work, but this is what I need.
Okay. So then the other part of that question was common pitfalls that you see when people are trying to implement this. Where are you seeing them kind of go?
Yeah. The biggest pitfalls where they kind of go rogue is, well, that website redesign one is always a big one, right? Like, let's just do the logo and the colors, the website. I'm like, oh my God, calm down. Do we have to do that right now? So sometimes creativity gets in everybody's way. I love it. I'm so excited. I want to be creative. That's a big pitfall. The second biggest pitfall is, candidly, you write the coolest message in the world. You don't update your sales materials immediately. And so you're not seeing any improvement at all. And you wonder what happened. Like, I'm talking like first week with my clients, sales materials are updated. Period. Point blank. Message needs to be changed, even if it doesn't look pretty yet and your graphic designer hasn't had a chance to make it look cool, okay? The third biggest pitfall that I would say is very common is that sales is not fully committed to making the shift. And that could have been because they weren't involved in the process, and hey, I get that, then that's not okay. But when sales leaders don't actually tell their teams and walk their teams through this new messaging and why it was created and where it's coming from and what we're trying to do, they don't train their teams immediately and say, this is where we're going. That team has no ability to get on board, and they'll continue to try their own things, go rogue every single call. It kind of has to be mandated at a certain point. Leaders have to be willing to say that.
So, and I would dare to say that, you know, our job, if we're a sales leader, you know, is going to have to be a whole lot of that development component. And then, you know, saying that, hey, this is a framework, this is an expectation, and here's where you can essentially add you into the mix.
That's exactly right. It's really helping them understand we're giving you that top level first 15 to 30 seconds. And then that person's like, that is so cool. So tell me how this works. And they can get into really cool stories because we had one client that we did this. And allowing that sales rep to not feel like a robot. Give them the framework. Give them the bullet points. Give them the core language. Okay, it's your backbone. And then teach your sales reps to understand, heck yes, you can have personality around that. Heck yeah, you can tell really cool stories and build that rapport. That's why they're in that job anyway. So we don't want them to feel like robots, but we want to make sure that they're hitting the big bullets up front so that the person goes, got it, now tell me more. And that's then where the magic happens.
So help me with a little bit of clarity around what people may talk about in regards to go-to-market strategy and what you're talking about here.
It's the same. You know, it's really interesting. I use the term branding, Jim, because that's the world that I'm in of marketing. But we're talking about go-to-market messaging. What exactly are you leading with for your go-to-market strategy? So I work with GTM teams 24/7 to build this exact thing. What's going out? You know, again, every component of their go-to-market strategy has to be rooted in the brand. What tactics they use, the processes that they've built behind the scenes, who's doing what, when, and why, everything should back into the brand. And that's why it's so important. It is the crux of a go-to-market strategy.
Okay, so I would dare to say, anytime you're dealing with a scenario where we're implementing something different, you know, we can call it whatever we want, transformation, optimization, I don't care. You know, we get resistance, and we have some challenges associated with that. So what are you finding as a common resistance to going through this process and implementing this change?
Couple big things. One, often it's misalignment between key stakeholders, key leaders. They have very different perspectives on where the company should go. Two, you may have some leaders in the room that feel very unheard or very undervalued. They're just going to dig their heels in. Three, most leaders that I work with actually care so much that they struggle to let go of the old and embrace the new because this is their baby and this is what they've built. And I really respect and understand that actually. And so it's a process when they're in the room to say, we're not trying to rebrand. We're not trying to reinvent who we are. This is about a quarter turn of the message. This is about tightening the bolts. How do we take what's been really good so far and actually enhance and improve that with efficiency and greatness? often that's what gets people to go, willing to not white knuckle this a little bit. I'm willing to kind of let this happen. I think the fourth thing is being very clear throughout the process. Everybody's got their role and responsibility. So how do I make sure your voice is really heard? You can't go build a brand in a box. So if I don't see ops in the room, I get concerned. If I don't see, you know, other core teams in the room, HR, like in my first call, I usually have HR there. What are employees saying? It's making sure that everybody has chance to weigh in, and you will find that you have far lesser roadblocks in implementing this across the organization.
Well, again, you said it like when we first started talking about the whole psychology element associated with this. I mean, you're talking about it both internally and externally.
It is. We're really getting at the heart of what are we saying to whom and why? And we have to recognize that there's a lot of emotion behind that, both for our customers, for us as employees, and for our leaders. Brand is very personal.
As you're saying then, we're talking about the whole psychology piece. You talked about strengths. I now also start thinking about differences in regards to gender. So in other words, if I have, you know, senior level leaders and they happen to be female, you know, versus male, do you find a different approach that you need to take, or, you know, different pitfalls that they run into?
It's interesting. I don't find it. This is interesting. I don't typically find it as it relates to gender. What I do find it is based on their communication style. So I don't know if you've heard of anything called DISC before, DISC communication, these four core types of communication. What often we see is such a blend across people in the way that they process information and the way that they therefore express themselves or communicate that we have to take that into account. One person may really need to feel heard and have this empathetic side about they care, that they don't want to rock the boat for employees with this project. And the other person's like, well, this better not affect our engineering processes. Don't you dare touch my processes. The other person's like, got it done now, you know? And then that type A salesperson's like, I just want everybody to have fun. This is going to be fun. And so wherever these people are at, we have to know how we're speaking the same language here and say, oh, okay, get it off your chest now. What do we all care about? What's the common thread? That's the thing we use to write the brand. And then they feel very excited. They actually do get on board. So it's communication styles, but understanding how to navigate that with a bit of transparency to go, well, we're actually all here for the same reason. So hold on. Let's get down to brass tacks. We're here to grow the business. So how do I make that happen?
Kate DeLeo, awesome conversation. How does the B2B DM gang get in touch with you?
First off, thanks for having me. The best way to get in touch with me would be through my website, www.katedeleo.com. You also can find me on LinkedIn. Hey, if you follow Jim and the podcast on LinkedIn, feel free to contact me. Send me a message if you've got a question. I respond to all of those personally right away. Would love to hear your thoughts. Love to see how I can just advocate for you guys too that are listening in today.
Kate DeLeo, thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom. And we would
thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Go now to join the B2B DM gang in the B2B Marketer LinkedIn group, where you can connect with other B2B DM disruptors and get access to our B2B DM cheat sheets, checklist, and guides. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, please help by going to iTunes to rate, review, and subscribe. And share the show on all of your digital platforms. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And always remember, you can automate your lead capture, but you must lure your lead.